the first talk of the day. I'm very pleased to welcome Janet Sermon back for summer school to give a talk on living in capitalism as a socialist. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks. I prefer to stand up. I can see more people and it's more comfortable. Pardon? Do I need to speak up a little bit? Can you hear me now?
Is the mic?
You can use the mic. Put this on.
Okay, I'll keep talking. Tell me when it's loud enough. Tell him when it's loud enough or whatever you want. Okay, how's that? Is that better? Okay, good. I don't have to shout. I'd just say to begin with, those of you who know me know that I prefer to read my notes because it's a short-term memory and I would get lost in myself. I wouldn't know where I was a few minutes in, so here I go. Okay, I hope that's all right for everybody.
Of course.
All right.
You have
notes. Right, so this is how I begin. Trying to get to the heart of this topic has been somewhat of a struggle. I'd like to get right away from the small scale and consider the much wider concept of how living in capitalism impacts on each and every individual on this planet. And coming up with a label is very tricky. It can't be internationalism, because that invokes nationalism, which I also want to get away from. Globalism has too many negative connotations, unfortunately, and can be misconstrued. So universalism comes closest to me, but I am talking solely about this planet in the universe, okay? Anyway, whatever the label, whoever we are, wherever we are, living wherever we do on this planet, we're all human beings, living within the many constraints of capitalism, having to deal with whatever's thrown at us, situations, events that are not of our individual or collective choice. And being convinced socialists, having acceptance that nothing less than a total change of how the world is organised has to have a profound effect on how we view the complexities surrounding us on a daily basis. Of course, it's natural to see each and all situations from one's own personal perspective and experience, but I also firmly believe it's imperative to understand as deeply as we can the other many perspectives of people of the wider world, to deliberately attempt to stand in each other's shoes. And it's not easy. I mean, just look at the people in the room today. Look at us. With a small group, no doubt, there are going to be some very different perspectives. You know, just this, and we're thinking along the same lines. But understanding the other takes some effort. I suppose what I'm saying, it's about the way we view the other or all the many different others. Living in capitalism, so much of everyone's perspective is understandably shaped by the global monetary system, the vastly different personal experiences within the context of location, situation, daily requirements, available funds, etc. They demonstrate many of the inequalities of the system. A couple of brief examples I've got here. They're very short. Think of big name companies. Garment production facilities in places like Bangladesh and other East Asian countries, where you've got thousands of workers living in compounds on poverty wages, so that customers in the West can have access to cheap clothes, whilst the owners and the shareholders reap larger profits, sucking blood or profit from bottom to top. And another short example to consider is the average Western tourist taking an all-expenses holiday in one of the many possible destinations somewhere in the so-called developing world. In what detail are they able to appreciate the vast differences between themselves and the local inhabitants that they can observe involved in their own daily lives? And do they wonder if those locals are also ever in a position to indulge in a holiday themselves, never mind an all-inclusive foreign one? And I'm sure everyone here could come up with a different example, either from the UK or further afield. We recognise it's all different parts of the same thing, the inequalities stemming from the system. Now, I really don't think I'm going to be adding anything new here today, nothing earth-shattering. It's more of just one person's look at an individual, any individual's position, and collective position, and I'm also interested to discover how our views will vary between optimism and pessimism when we think of the everyday life of individuals around the globe, from poverty-stricken to mega-wealthy, plus all the rest of us, especially us, the vast, the overwhelmingly vast majority. Perhaps along the way, we can add depth to some of our experiences within the system, meanwhile helping us to further our common ambition of socialism. Here's the biggest problem, I think, and it's time. What time do we have to achieve our aim of a socialist world for the good of the planet, its biodiversity and all its myriad inhabitants? We have to consider, in no particular order, except for global warming, I think, which should be probably top of the list, the ever-increasing nuclear threat, war with all its interferences, hegemonic control, massive use of resources, and consequently equally massive emissions, plus our three basic needs, air, water and food, all of them more and more polluted and poisonous as the years dash by. So time is not on our side. However many bullet points we collectively would wish to include, I'll bet, though, that each one is as it is simply because it's necessary for the profit system, even though none of them are good for the planet and all its natural dependents. It appears that we are so firmly entrenched in the system that we need to persuade people that it's not a natural system that we are born into. For instance, no one's born a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Buddhist, a Taoist, whatever. We're all born as babies with no preconceived notions as to religion. Plus, it's simply taken for granted that you're English, Scottish, Iranian, Peruvian because of where you're born. Again, no choice. Well, isn't that the same regarding political outlook? No one is born a capitalist or a supporter of the capitalist system either. But we're born in a box, it seems, with a predetermined label. As we grow up, then we are moulded into societal norms and accepted customs, often with little thought about it, especially during the most formative period of our lives, early childhood. Here's a personal thing. Why did my childhood and teenage years living in a village centre around the church? Because that's where the young gathered, or they were sent, as brownies, cubs, guides, scouts, for youth clubs and choirs with sports activities, amateur dramatics, annual days out to the seaside. Well, we had some fun and we learned to do a few new things. Similarly at school, when at 11 we were put into groups and sent this way and that to separate schools, the bigger schools, according, supposedly, on aptitude or merit. All the way through that experience, between 5 and 7 years of secondary school, what were our thoughts for the future? How did we make our decisions? Did we really grow up thinking of how our future lives could develop with any real choices? Or were we compartmentalised according to the choices on offer regarding the subjects that we were deemed capable of mastering? And at a certain time, it was accepted that we should start to think about what job, what line of work we could do, knowing that really, whatever we chose, whether entering the world of work, further training or education, that ultimately we were going to be looking for something that would pay us enough to get started in life. But started at what? I mean, how many at that time in life really grasped the enormity of the limits that are placed onto us as we enter adult life, to be denied many of the possibilities we'd earlier dreamed of? Expectations for many would become dumbed down, with really little encouragement to look beyond the established norms. I'm simply trying to draw attention here to the limits, the various hardships of wage or salaried work, the restrictions on our personal choices, simply because we live in a system in which everything is related one way or another to money. Until and unless the majority are consciously aware of the undeniable facts of that matter and are prepared to work together to replace capitalism with socialism, time will run out and it will be too late. And it struck me quite forcibly recently just how many lies we have to live with on a daily basis. There's a general denial by spokespersons for government, multinational corporations, international organisations and mainstream media to be if I say totally open and honest, or somewhat open and honest, to tell the whole truth, to actually give some indication that they are listening to their electorate, their customers, their readers. Instead, there's a kind of, if we say it loudly enough and often enough, our point, whatever point that might be, will strike home and be accepted as fact. So often this kind of brain-numbing, brain-dumbing is used successfully on populations, leaving only minorities attempting to challenge the misinformation and the lies. And it's lies. I've got a few examples here which, you know, just came up as I was putting this together. There are so many more, but here are the ones that I just jotted down. For instance, cooking up false reasons, which happens so often, the excuses for military involvement around the world. What came to mind instantly were then, when I wrote it, Kosovo, Serbia, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., etc., infinitum, I wrote. Pre-intervention in Iraq was probably the largest demonstration against war ever in this country, but did it make a difference? Did it turn out to be the truth? That's something about 20 minutes. You remember the reason for going? It could all happen in 20 minutes and it'd be too late if we didn't. And that was put forward as the reason for invasion. What about the ongoing fuss of false claims, misreporting and downright lies surrounding the hyped-up anti-Semitism clamour that you've connected recently, you've had and still going on, connected to British, members of the British Parliament this year? Has the way this has been conducted been at all helpful to the general populace? The way that also the way the Labour Party caved in and accepted that ridiculous statement under pressure, which doesn't actually match anything to do with what we were talking about of anti-Semitism. Again, where was the rational debate enabling the general populace to have their say on the matter? Then what about the incident of the downed MH17 over Donbass in Ukraine? The misrepresentation, which I would actually call a lie, by the media and various political authority figures in order to create a propaganda attack on Russia. When I wrote this bit, it was just a couple of days after the Prime Minister of Malaysia had surprised the world by speaking out about the lack of evidence and the lies that had been told around this tragic event, plus the fact that Malaysia, whose plane and majority passengers they were denied the opportunity to conduct their own investigations. But it's too late now for many, because they've heard the lies for too long. It's these that are now firmly fixed in their minds and memories. The Iranian nukes saga is still continuing. How and why can it still go on when the relevant experts have clearly stated there's no violation of the agreement? But it does still continue, and once again, the Iranian public are the ones suffering from lack of medication and vital imports because of the sanctions placed upon them. Iran's isolation from the West began many decades ago. They decided they'd have enough of the West, particularly the UK, pillaging their oil. At that time, British Petroleum's control and unfair share of the profits became too much for them in Iran, and at the general election, threw out the Shah in favour of Prime Minister Mossadegh, a lot of you remember, and what they saw as democracy. But it wasn't to last long, because within a few years, the UK, with later assistance from the CIA, etc., they fomented street protests. Mossadegh was brought down in 1953, and the new Shah was installed as another puppet of the West, until 1979, when another revolution, reviled by the West, changed it all again. And now we have, this was mid-June, a false flag on two tankers in the Persian Gulf. I know some people were talking about it yesterday evening. The truth is out there, actually, if only people can get to hear it. But how is it that people can be fooled this easily? And what about through lots of years, US assassinations of political figures throughout the generations have often been hyped up as conspiracy theories. Maybe some of them are. But what about JF Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the second Kennedy, Robert? False information, poor evidence gathering, cover-ups, lies. Do we really know the truth behind these and other weird events culminating in politically connected individuals falling out of windows from great heights and other strange non-natural life-ending happenings? A fairly current one is the the ongoing situation in Venezuela. The US and its Western allies hangers-on. Plus, there's a lot of tiny, what I would call, US-dependent on US dollar states. They're so small, they can't decide anything for themselves because they're going to be overruled. And they just continue to hang on to the lies they've invented around the situation in Venezuela. They have to have dominance no matter what. One mustn't be seen to be supporting another nation against the wishes of the US, especially if that nation has the world's largest deposits of oil. And this is also why tiny Cuba is again suffering from sanctions. I thought this was interesting. I need to mention, regarding war, going back to the 1947 United Nations General Assembly resolution, and I think it's appropriate here because the US has made it quite plain that's what they wanted in Venezuela, some kind of invasion, anything to bring Maduro down. And this is the text from November the 3rd, 1947. The General Assembly condemns all forms of propaganda in whatsoever country conducted, which is either designed or likely to provoke or encourage any threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression. In short, propaganda is a war crime. That brought to mind another war. Well, I don't see this as a war, actually, but another illegal invasion. Afghanistan, which has been going on for, you know, how long? Now, if this invasion wasn't preceded by propaganda for war, then what can I say? Nearly two decades on, and it's been made abundantly clear that there's no way the US is going to leave. And it was discovered just a handful of years ago that Afghanistan has an abundant supply of rare earth metals. And now that China has declared it will no longer supply the US with rare earth metals mined in China, there is the perfect reason to stay, even if not admitted. Another lie? Series of lies? Here's one relating to the UK. This example has actually been around for decades. I think I first read about it in The Spokesman, what's he called? Burton Russell Foundation. They have some very interesting stuff. This is one of the things they covered quite a few years ago. So it seemed to be only known by a minority in the UK until fairly recently, but it must have hit the headlines here just a month or so ago. I'm talking about the sheer scandal of the Chagos Islands, yeah? And the islanders. It was covered up by both Labour and Conservative governments. They denied it totally. First, there were denials that there were any established settled people there, those who'd been moved out lock, stock and barrel. Later, the declaration of a protected sea area for nature as some kind of weird cover-up, or for a super-duper holiday complex-style military base, Diego Garcia. And the recent ruling by the International Court of Justice that Britain should leave the Chagos Islands as rapidly as possible was ignored. So this was followed up by Mauritius calling on the United General Assembly for a vote. The vote was supported by 116 countries. Six voted against, including Britain and the US, and 71 either abstained or didn't vote, and they were generally the very tiny countries that really they didn't want to vote for, but they didn't vote against. Proud to be British is what I thought about that, you know. Anyway, let's not forget something else here, the lies of corporations. We all know about these. For instance, the current lawsuits in the US against the former Monsanto, now Bayer, where individuals now at last are being granted millions of dollars, and there's a long list of individual and class actions waiting to be heard. I think everybody's heard of glyphosate, the chemical ingredient used in their patented herbicides and pesticides. It's been years of cover-ups and denials, actually decades, from denials from company scientists and spokespersons, plus thorough denigration of independent scientist findings and character assassinations of particular scientists. Now it seems there will at last be some recompense for some of the affected, although how widespread it will be. So far it's Americans in court. Can it? Will it go global? Remember, the hundreds of thousands of farmers in debt in India who have killed themselves over two decades, many from consuming these very products. That reminds us, doesn't it, of the tobacco industry and their powerful lobby for many years, denying the dangers of smoking. I'm sure we all remember that. Maybe the numbers of smokers in some parts of the world have reduced, but they're now promoting their products in large parts of the world generally labelled as undeveloped. There's profit to be had there too. And the sugar companies, blaming fat while knowing that sugar was the problem, all uncovered after the enormous damage from the lies was done. Sick or what? Doesn't the constant stream of lies make you angry? I thought what would be really useful for reference on this topic, first of all, I thought a compendium, a world compendium of lies. But then again, better still, an online source with global contributions and, of course, available in every language. Imagine how many editions there could be weekly from around the world with the current system shored up by lies. Let's face it, everyone really does need to be awakened thoroughly to the sham that our societies are built on. Quite simply about control of resources, subsequent profit and contempt for the majority who actually do all the work. Only then can we begin to rebuild society, taking into account the needs and the wishes of all. I'm moving on here to protest now. I would like to cover a little bit of thing about protest. I have to fully admit to being guilty of the charge of protesting. Protesting about all manner of things, situations I thought were wrong. Wrong for people, wrong for the planet, just so obviously wrong, unjust, wrong. But I was wrong too. I hadn't at that stage in my life sussed that even if what I was protesting was changed, it probably wouldn't reach the desired result. Anti-apartheid, anti-nuclear, anti-Vietnam War, war in general, boycotting South Africa and Israeli goods, signatures, meetings, protests, all-night vigils, you name it, I was there. I even had a one-person protest outside a small factory near the village where we lived. I can't even remember why now. It was probably because they were supplying South Africa or buying from or something, OK? Just me, OK? Who knows? It doesn't matter now.
And your own policeman.
Oh, don't shush. Anyway, did I say this bit? I mean, whatever the protests were, they were all single issues. And that's what's so bothersome now. Because some of us here, I'm sure, probably like me, learned the hard way, the slow way. But others will have grasped it sooner. But there are millions out there now doing their absolute best to change all kinds of things for the better. We know that if only we could get them to see the big picture. Stop wasting their time and energy on one thing, and so we could all work together to achieve all our aims by bringing down the culprit, which is the overarching system of capitalism. So what can we witness being protested around the world at the moment? Well, you've got nationals and residents of one country protesting issues in another country, which I find slightly odd now. I used to, but I find it really sort of a bit funny now. For instance, Western countries protesting against China's abuse of the Uyghurs and the Falun Gong, while their own governments are involved in killing so many people in other countries like Syria and Somalia and Yemen, while actually they're illegally anyway. Plus, they have large numbers of immigrants or asylum seekers in detention centres in their own place, in their own country, for undefined periods, often in dire conditions, not knowing if they're going to be allowed to stay or to be shipped back to their own countries of origin to face who knows what reception. Bit of a funny thing there. We've got Extinction Rebellion, this global movement involving significant numbers of youngsters still in school. Now, I really can admire their efforts and energy in putting this huge issue in front of everybody, because few can be unaware of it now. But it won't, it can't halt all the necessary parts of what needs to be done to actually achieve what they're after, because there will still be that system with all its defences up to slow them down, to thwart them at every step, push them back, just like the many other processes we've observed in our lifetimes, and in fact the lifetime of the SPGB. The issues don't go away. There may be some amelioration, but facts, figures, statistics and history reveal that the problems don't get solved. And yes, global warming is one, if not the most crucial thing to be tackled immediately, or decades ago. I hate to think of the huge disappointment that's to come for many, especially of these youngsters who are going to have to deal with what is coming their way. There's another little one here. The US has an ongoing debate and all kinds of protests about the increasing price of drugs. It's more and more privatised as the minutes tick by, and some of them are crucial to life-threatening illnesses. Something once costing, a month ago, costing $35 a month, overnight becomes $1,000, and it leaves people knowing not what to do. But you've got a multitude of lobbyists pressing individuals and government to support their products and companies. So the people who are protesting about it stand little chance. And the pharmaceuticals industry is, I believe, it's the second most profitable after the military. It's huge, huge. And I just thought about that with the military. Is Prince Andrew still the UK military hardware international sales business? Is still in that, Prince Andrew? Or has he retired from that? Tell me later. Another mention of the military worldwide. It won't go amiss. There are far too many separate issues to get into in depth. So just a brief look at some of them. The huge waste of... You've probably all heard me say this before, this bit. The huge waste of material resources, the damage done in resource exploitation, transportation, manufacture.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
OK. All before an exercise can begin, and really before a single shot or bomb is dropped, OK? We know that over the years there have been plenty of protests about war of all kinds in many locations, and yet year on year the budget globally on average increases. And while it's obviously the capitalist system itself that needs and supports these massive corporations, there's still an enormous discontent and anger around the globe regarding war, invasion, military overthrow of governments and regimes. Do we really believe that a majority of the global population would actually vote for this aggression against other populations if they were given the chance? Capitalism has its own agenda, just like politicians have their agenda about which foreign governments they support or regimes they oppose. With war, diplomacy doesn't enter into it. It's about succeeding with their own agenda. It's irrelevant how many protesters are out there on the streets. The politicians will still go ahead regardless. It's rarely otherwise. And it's a similar scenario in all areas. Business interests must come first, for obvious reasons. Surely, with all the different single issues that one way or another hold back or prevent the majority from reaching their potential or having their voices heard and responded to, it's quite clear that democracy is neither valued nor respected by those in power. So I don't know about you, but except for attending now to hand out socialist literature and engaging with protesters, I now feel frustration about protests in general, when so much more could be achieved getting together to overthrow the current system for all our sakes. If most of what I've said so far seems incredibly negative, maybe it is, but I would have to add, I believe it's true. And as one would-be socialist living in capitalism, I'm angry a lot of the time, aren't I? Really angry and somewhat depressed sometimes, but we have to face up to reality. If we are to share our case for socialism in the here and now, we have to see it all for what it is. So a little positive, and I'm looking at a particular person now because of a little discussion we had yesterday evening. This is the quotation, I wonder if anybody recognises it. Be realistic and do the impossible. Because if we don't do the impossible, we face the unthinkable. Anybody? Murray Bookchin. Murray Bookchin, I'm looking at Brian. About half a century ago, I've mentioned resources a number of times in passing. Resources, the basic things we need to support our daily lives, from the materials to make egg cups, teaspoons, to the very fabric of our living accommodation, from components of our washing machines to the intricacies of the worldwide infrastructure, transport, internet, etc. Resources, some local, some from the other side of the world, we've come to require an enormously wide range of resources. Murray Bookchin had quite a lot to say about resources. He was telling us quite some decades ago that we should be looking more closely at how we use them, as was Barry Commoner and Rachel Carson, she who was much maligned for her warnings on poisonous substances in farming and now echoed regularly by Richard Heinberg. They all believed in the principle of circularising the economy, or steady state economy, if you like, really meaning use everything appropriately. Don't waste, but reduce, repair, reuse, recycle over and over, as occurs naturally in nature. Now, I don't doubt that some of us here would have endorsed these principles both at the time and since. In the reality of socialism, it would presumably be a foundational principle endorsed by all. But this is the question I'm coming to. Of all the resources that we use daily, which do you consider to be the most useful, the most valuable? Please say if you have something you've got on your mind quickly now. Do you... That you consider the most valuable resource. Do you have one? Isn't he great? What have I put here? I ignore that bit because you didn't say any of those. I'm pleased to say the first one was it's our human resource. Absolutely, it's our human resource. Much underused, undervalued, and with incredible waste of talent and energy, because keeping great numbers of workers unemployed whilst overworking the employed suits the monetary system better. For socialism, this must surely be the most valuable resource on the planet. What benefits we have in store for our future here. Our human resource just has to be our most valuable asset. Consider for a minute the waste in this area, human waste, in the capitalist system. So much non-productive, non-useful work. More and more human potential is trapped in low-grade work and very large numbers recruited and trained for the business of playing with money. Just for money's sake. I'm not going into any detail here. It's too depressing, too daft to laugh at, and you've heard it all before. But I must comment on the human misery attached to jobs, the kind of work people don't want to do, to the conditions they don't want to work in, for recompense that hardly keeps them alive. And yet they do it in their millions, in their billions even, because they have to. They don't have a choice. It seems incomprehensible to me when I look at how much time wasting there is for people employed in this monetary system, that we treat intelligent life as drones. Let's face it, there's plenty of evidence all around the world to show us that on the whole, people are very good at cooperating. Vast numbers of people love this way of living and organising, contributing as a community. Governments and the laws they come up with reveal little or no interest in the vast majority. They don't recognise the huge demonstrations we're seeing so many of around the world. Politicians are more interested in staying in their positions as authorities, nurturing that feeling of power. The UK is fairly representative of this when you look at their pay scale and the percentage increase they award themselves year on year compared with the average citizen. How can they relate to the rest of us when they're so far removed from our realities? And although it seems that politicians are the ones making the decisions, because we know it's not the populace, aren't they in many areas just beholden to the financiers? And why are so many politicians advisor to this company or that? How come so many move on to boards of international corporations or start their own version of some tax haven scheme or other? It may seem to the punters that the politicians are holding the reins, but above them are the puppet masters pulling their strings. Now consider the opposite. when all the richness of human potential can be released to the satisfaction and pleasure even of billions of individuals. A world without the constraints of a money economy will free us from these system-made, deliberate limitations which have deprived us of truly equal opportunities, equitable conditions, free choices and democracy. We will at last be free to make decisions based on common sense, to choose the contributions we want to make, to add value to our own and others' lives. Yes, I really do see this as common sense versus the profit motive. A demonstration of how a truly democratic system would work in the interests of all, which is totally opposed to the capitalist raison d'etre, profit. Now, put aside all the business and marketing aspects for a moment and think of the fantastically diverse array, amazing, interesting, fascinating, practical, innovative human resources we have. From food production of every variety, wonderful music for all different tastes, art, engineering, puzzle solving, communications, arts, literature, all coming to fruition because of the wonderful diversity of the human mind with its inquisitiveness, adventurousness, empathy and creativity. And although it seems we socialists live daily with anger at the manufactured news and information and at the concocted truths by the powerful in governments globally, and at the lawlessness of much of individual and supposedly transnational and international justice systems. For our sanity, we need to give ourselves pause for thought and let our imaginations have some time to consider all the wonderful things in the many areas we could, would achieve when we're free to get on with it. Young individuals in the supposed developed world, instead of being unemployed or underemployed as now, and young individuals of the underdeveloped world who are currently working in extremely dangerous conditions or working all hours of the days of the week for a pittance, will be free to engage in useful work of their own choice and have access to our communal wealth. The older generations will likewise at last be free to choose how to spend their later years, retire at last if that's they want, instead of being forced to struggle on with work just so that they can either eat or heat their homes, or, if they choose, stay engaged with their work, their contribution. Contributing to the common good is fulfilling, rewarding. Age shouldn't come into it. But a balanced life should be available to all. That's time again. Many of us don't have enough of it to be able even to dream about some of the things that we would like to achieve. This will be one of the huge differences, meaning lives with time for hunting in the morning, fishing in the afternoon, blah, blah, blah. Whatever, according to your own agenda, physical, mental, artistic, scientific, and all for free. All investments will be for the good of all. Investments of time. Time is all that's required for everything that's grown, tendered, manufactured, or service rendered. It's totally arse about face to complicate things with an extra cost and money value. Simply release everyone to do their bit, have free access to our Commonwealth, and the equation changes drastically. The time will be ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Yeah, very passionately put, and quite uplifting as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.